up some Sunday mornings and go, I'm just peacing out today. Win Arn, a church consultant, surveyed 1,000 churches. And he asked them one question. Why does the church exist? Now, see, we have conflicting thoughts about church. Because if you understand the New Testament, you understand the New Testament, when they talked about the church, they didn't talk about a location. Right? We in our modern times, affiliate church with a location and an address and a time frame. When the reality is this is not a church, this is a building. Now, I know some people get really squirrely when you say stuff like that, but it's not. The church is a group of people. The Greek word literally means a called out assembly. So when the New Testament, the early church, thought about church, they thought about people, they didn't think about locations. But when Win Arn asked the question, why does the church exist? 1,000 churches, because I like round numbers, we're going to say there are 100 people in each church. So 100,000 people. There might have been more, there might have been less, but go with me on this. 89%, 9 out of 10 people said the church exists to meet my needs and the needs of my family. 11%, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Thank you. You guys are the perfect row. Hold on. Welcome. No, not you, dude. Yeah, no, sorry. Not you. So you 9 said that the church exists to meet your needs. You, buddy, were the only one who was right. 11% said the church exists to take the gospel to the world. Do you know why we have such conflict and trouble in churches? Because people have a misunderstanding of what the church, the mandate of the church, the calling of the church should be. C.S. Lewis said this, "The church exists for nothing else but to draw people into Christ. If they are not doing that, all the cathedrals, clergy, missions, sermons, even the Bible itself are simply a waste of time. God became human for no other purpose." It's interesting. Do you remember being taught not to use extreme words? Never. Right? Never say never. C.S. Lewis basically throws the gauntlet down. He says, if we do not get this idea that the church exists to bring people into a relationship with Christ, then literally everything we do is wrong. Think about that. The church exists. Jesus took human form. Jesus died on the cross so that we would be his messengers to people who have not yet encountered him. Peter Drucker, leadership and management consultant, says this, "The mission comes first, and the mission of the church is to change lives. The function of leadership is to make the church more church-like, not make the church more business-like." But listen to this. "An organization begins to die the day it begins to run for the benefit of the insiders and not for the benefit of the outsiders." I pastored for over 20 years. Do you know what I found? I found that people want things to be for them. How many of you have ever been on a cruise ship? Oh, are cruise ships not epic? Teresa and I did an Alaskan cruise one time. And like day 3, I'm like, Jesus would not take a cruise. And she looked at me, she goes, well, no, duh, he'd walk on the water. She said, why wouldn't you? I said, nobody should literally be treated like this. We went to dinner the first night. And when we got there, they had us seated at a table for 8. And I'm like, no, I go on vacation, I become antisocial. Because as a pastor, I was always dealing with people. I don't want to deal with people on vacation. I know it's selfish, but it's true. So I went up to the guy, I'm like, hey, can I just get a table for 2? My wife and I are on vacation. Literally the only person I want to talk to is her. And he's like, yes. So we get a table for 2, and we're sitting at our table for 2, and it's romantic, and we're dressed up, and the music is playing, and the lights are twinkling, and the guy brings out our dinner, and they had this side dish. It was a carrot flan. Have you ever had carrot flan? I never had either. It was utterly amazing. And I'm like, wow, this is great. The next night we go to dinner, and it's not on the menu. And I'm like, well, I'm just kind of bummed out. And I said to the guy, oh, I was hoping it'd be on the menu all week. He's like, no, it was just on last night. So then when he brought my dinner, guess what he brought me? He brought me my carrot flan. Guess what he brought me the rest of the week? My carrot flan, even though it wasn't on the menu, because I wanted it. And I was on a cruise ship, and the purpose of a cruise ship is this, literally to make you happy. That's it. That's what they live for. They live to serve you. We would finish our dinner, and we'd be a little full. So I'd be like, hey, send the dessert to my room. I tried that at home. That didn't work. And we would show up at our room, and there would be the dessert, beautifully plated. Wow. Then one year, we all went to Hawaii for vacation, and everybody got to pick what they did. My oldest daughter and I wanted to see the battleship Missouri. How many of you have ever heard of the battleship Missouri? Battleship Missouri was commissioned during World War II. It was the battleship that the Japanese Imperial Court, Army, Navy signed their unconditional surrender. So my daughter and I do this tour of the battleship Missouri, and it's 3 football fields long. For those of you who don't know the measurement of a football field, it's 900 feet. It's a mass. It's got 9 16-inch guns that can fire a 2,500-pound shell 39 kilometers. So basically, if you shot the shell from here, you could almost put it downtown St. Thomas. That's how big this thing was, massive. Anyways, we didn't pay for the tour. Don't judge me too harshly on this. We didn't pay for the tour because I'm cheap, but we connected ourselves far enough away from the paid tour, so don't be hating, so that we could get the benefits of the paid tour without paying for the tour. Do you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, you all have done it too. But as we went, what fascinated me is the guy who was giving the tour would say, and so this station, this was their job. This was their responsibility. And this station, this was their job, and this was their responsibility. And everybody knew what their job was, and everybody knew what to do. And when an attack came, everybody manned battle stations, and they did what they were supposed to do. Here's what I think. I think the church has become a cruise ship, when in fact, it needs to be a battleship. I think people come to church, and they sit in their pews. How many of you have a pew? Right? When I went to sit down today, I had to remember where Leonard and Sherry sat. I'm like, okay, what's our pew? I used to pastor this church. This old guy used to come in, and he would get there early. Like, we're talking 45 minutes early, so that he could have his pew. And if you got there first and sat in his pew, he would literally ask you to leave. How insane is that? Because his thinking is, I've been here for the past 57 years, and that's my pew. We, sometimes in the church, have taken this attitude. I can do it with both fingers. I snap my finger, and you do what I ask you to do. That's what God never intended. God never intended the church to become a cruise ship. God never intended that we would get so comfortable that we would expect that all of our needs were going to be met by the church. We expect the church to accommodate us, and you know what the church has done? And I'm not just talking about your church. I'm talking about the church in general in some respects. The church has created a schedule that makes us busy. I bet, and I'm not going to do this because I'll leave this for you to do. I bet if you went through your bulletin, you could be busy 5-6 days a week if you want it. There's always stuff. And I remember as a young Christian going to church, and I remember these old guys would go, every time the church doors are open, I'm there. And I remember as a young Christian thinking, that's really dumb. Because all you're going to do is make yourself busy. And see, by making ourselves busy and doing churchy things. And by the way, probably like most of you, I work with predominantly people who don't go to church. And here's what I find interesting. Our idea of evangelism is to invite somebody to church. Do you know how freaky we are? Just think about this. Do you know how just utterly terrifying it would be to come to a church if you don't go to church? Think about it. Teresa and I have friends that are Buddhist. And if they invited us to a Buddhist temple, I would probably go. But I would be freaked out the whole time. You want to know why? Because I know nothing about Buddhist temples. It would be fascinating, and I would go because I'm not really concerned about becoming a Buddhist. But the reality is we think, oh, I've got my neighbor, I'm going to invite him to church. And what's literally the first thing we do in church? We sing. There is, worship team, please do not take this offensively. There is nothing weird about singing if you have no experience in that. Could you imagine going to a meeting at work and all of a sudden they bring out and we're going to sing songs? You're going to be like, y'all are crazy. We're weird in some ways. And it's just because it's our internal culture. And we like it, and it makes us feel comfortable, but the reality is inviting somebody to church isn't necessarily the best thing. It's about building relationships with people. And what I want to talk about this morning is this whole mandate to be witnesses in our world, to be light and salt. See, we work with people, we live next to them, we live with them, we shop with them, we interact socially with them, we play sports with them, your kids might play sports with them, you serve on teams with them. People who need Christ influence and are involved in probably every aspect of your life. And what they're looking for is sincerity and genuineness. I met way too many people who are not interested in sharing their faith. I had an elder one time. And we were talking about this, and he goes, Pastor Greg, I work with these people all week long. I don't want to hang out with them. And I went, wow, that was your outside voice. And he goes, no, I don't like them. I don't want to hang out with them. I don't want to share my faith with them. And so I said, you probably shouldn't be an elder, which is probably one of the reasons I'm no longer a pastor anymore. But that's just one of many. Listen to Mark chapters 3. Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the lake, and a large crowd from Galilee followed. When they heard about all he was doing, many people came from Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, and the regions across Jordan around Tyre and Sidon. Because of the crowd, he told his disciples to have a small boat made ready for him to keep the people from crowding him. For he had healed many, so that those with diseases were pushing forward to touch him. Whenever the impure spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried, "You are the Son of God." But he gave them strict orders not to tell others about him. Now, to get the impact from this passage, we have to go back a verse, where it says in verse 6, "Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus." All right? Then it goes, "And Jesus withdrew." So what happens is Jesus has this big confrontation with the religious leaders to heal a guy on the Sabbath, and they say he can't do it, but he does it. And in my mind, it seemed like an extreme response from the Pharisees. They decided to kill Jesus. So Jesus takes off. He withdrew his disciples to the lake, and he does so for two reasons. Number one, because the Pharisees were out for his head. And number two, because the people wouldn't leave him alone. Listen to these verses. The whole town gathered at the door. Mark 1:33. What's close to town? Lucan? Could you imagine opening your door? It's Saturday morning. You've slept in. Your hair's like, and you're in your PJs, and they're ripped, and you got your nasty slippers on. You haven't brushed your teeth. And you open the door, and the whole town of Lucan is outside. And they want something from you. That's what Jesus lived with. Mark 1:35-37. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions, the disciples, went looking for him. When they found him, they exclaimed, "Hey, everyone is looking for you." Mark 1:40-45, a man with leprosy came to him and begged him on his knees, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." Filled with compassion, Jesus reached out, remember that word compassion, by the way, and touched his hand and reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said, "be clean." Immediately, the leprosy left him and he was cured. Jesus sent him away at once with a stern warning. You ever get a stern warning? "See that you don't tell this to anyone, but go show yourself to the priests and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them." Instead, he went out and began to talk freely, spreading the news. As a result, Jesus could no longer enter a town openly. He could no longer enter a town openly, but had to stay outside in lonely places, yet the people still came to him from everywhere. Mind you, if you had leprosy, leprosy was, oh man, you had no human contact. Which is why whenever you see Jesus heal somebody with leprosy, he almost always touches them. Lepers had to announce their disease. That's handy. You ever meet somebody with a cold? Don't you wish they would announce it before you shake their hand? "I have a cold. Right? You're like, oh man, I shook your hand and you just wiped your nose and now I'm going to be sick for a month. Lepers, they had to announce, "I have leprosy." And people would run away from them, just like we should do with people with colds. Right? And Jesus says, "Don't tell anybody, do this." And dude's like, "Man, I'm healed. I am telling everybody that I'm healed." Mark chapter 2, verses 1 through 2. A few days later, when Jesus again entered Capernaum, the people heard that he had come home. They gathered in such large numbers that there was no room left, not even outside the door, and he preached the word to them. Mark 2:13, once again, Jesus went out beside the lake. A large crowd came to him, and he began to teach them. Here's an interesting twist in this story. Jesus heals a guy on the Sabbath, and the Pharisees decide that that was an act punishable by death. But the crowd mobbed him. So you have Jesus doing one thing, getting two different responses. People that hated him for it, and people that loved him and were drawn to him for it. That's kind of the story of Christianity and Christians, don't you think? Some people, and I don't know where the news reports find these people from our tribe, but have you ever seen Christians interviewed on the news? It's like, how hard did you guys look for this? Right, you watch them and you're like, oh my goodness, I don't want to be affiliated. Because they get the most extreme of our tribe to say stuff, right? And we get painted with that brush. Whether it's right or not, whether it's fair or not is irrelevant. But some people were drawn to Jesus and some people were repelled by him. In my current job, because my business card, do all of you know what I do for a living? Take a very deep breath, 4 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4. Let it out, 1, 2, 3, 4. Don't breathe in, 1, 2, 3, 4. Are you good? Okay. So I work for a company called Flying Monkeys Craft Brewery. Are you with me? So for those of you who are now, the squirrels are turning, I sell beer for a living. Now, I love my job. And this is going to be hard for you to believe, but there is not a lot of Christian influence in the craft beer world. And I just lost half of you. We have met one other couple who are Christians. Now, the company I work for calls their followers beer disciples. So I decided, you know what? What do disciples need? Disciples need a pastor. So my business card says beer pastor right on it. And I hand that bad boy out. By the thousands, I hand my business card out. And people will read it, and they pause. And they go, "Beer pastor, really? Why is that?" And I say, "Because I was a pastor for 20 years. And for the most part, it does shut some conversations down, in fairness. But for the most part, it opens up a ton of conversations. And in the 3+ years I've done this, I probably had over 25 conversations with people who say this: "Well, I used to go to church, or I was raised in church, but I don't go anymore." So obviously I have to ask him the question, okay, why don't you go anymore? Guess what their answer is? Because people in the church, finish it for me, are, thank you. Wow, I should not have had to beg that much. People in the church are hypocrites. Now, I would like to say to you that that is the number one answer I get. It's not. It is the only answer I get. And the first time I let it go, all right, people, right, I've heard this for decades. Yeah, people, church, hypocrites, blah, 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 blah. So after the first time, I'm like, no way, I'm not letting this slide. So I say to them, okay, you know what, I've heard this for decades. I need a story. How are the people in the church hypocrites? One of my friends that works in the craft beer world is an atheist, and he's an atheist by conviction, not by choice. You with me? An atheist by choice goes, eh, it's not for me. An atheist by conviction says, y'all are dangerous. He is an atheist by conviction. His exact words are, you religious people are extremely dangerous and should be stopped. And I went, okay, I'll bite. Why? So he goes, I don't want to tell you. And I said, why? He goes, I don't want to talk about it. I'm like, that's ridiculous. You brought it up, you have to talk about it. So then he tells me his story. From the time he was born to the time he was 16, he was raised in an evangelical gospel preaching church. And then when he was 16 years old, it was revealed that his dad, his spiritual elder of the church dad, was having an affair. Now, that would be bad, but it wasn't just one affair. His dad was a serial adulterer. He had multiple affairs by the time it all came out. And my friend said, if this is what Christianity is like, I'm done. And he walked away. And he just didn't walk away and go, I'm not going to church. He walked away and said, I'm an atheist. I literally don't believe this anymore. And I have heard story after story. Because when I said, tell me, and they started to, I'm like, okay, yeah, you know what? I kind of have to agree with you. We are hypocrites. Probably not, but some of us are. I was talking to a customer who was he was telling me the story. He goes, so when I used to be in sales, we had this guy, his name was, I don't remember his name, we'll call him Bob. Bob's a great name, right? You can spell it backwards and forwards the same way. He said, and Bob went on vacation, so he took over Bob's territory. And he went to Bob's number one customer. This guy brought more of Bob's product than anybody else. And he walks in, and the guy sees him, and he goes, oh, good, you're not Bob. And the guy's like, what do you mean, good, I'm not Bob? Because apparently Bob wasn't just selling the product. Bob was hardcore selling Jesus, too, every time he went in. And my buddy goes, you love Bob. You're like his biggest customer. The guy's like, I hate Bob. Every time Bob comes in here, he tells me what a horrible guy I am. Every time Bob comes in here, he tells me that I'm a sinner, I'm going to hell. He said, the only reason I buy so much stuff from Bob is because if I didn't, I'd see him three times more often. We could do better. We have to do better. Christianity isn't simply losing its influence, gang. Christianity has lost its influence. Christianity is no longer the predominant worldview in our culture, and it's becoming less and less so. And let me say this, I think that's a good thing. I think the more influence we lose, the more influential our voices can be one-on-one. See, because we've used our influence as a platform, and I don't think Jesus ever intended that to happen. I think Jesus intended for us to be people who worked in people's lives and loved them and had compassion with them. See, it's not our job to point out sins or mistakes in effort to condemn or judge people. How many of you are judgmental? Oh, don't even think of lying to me. Come on, how many of you're like, I'm judgmental, I know it. You bunch of judgy people. I'm judging you for being judgmental. Thank you for being honest. Why are we judgmental? Here, I'll answer it for you. What's that? Pride. We think we're right. See, this is the problem that we have in church. We make everything a high moral issue. How many of, do we have hymn books? Ooh, can we go down the hymn path just for fun? How many of you like hymns? How many of you think Jesus likes hymns? How many of you think Jesus really doesn't care? Here's what I think. I think Jesus wants our hearts. I don't care if you sing hymns or you're rocking out with screaming guitars and drum kits. It doesn't matter. You can sing hymns and have a crappy attitude. And that's not okay. See, because we moralize stuff, we make things right and wrong, and some things are right and wrong, but not half as many as we want it to be. We become judgmental against people who are different than us. Listen to me. We live in a world that proclaims it's tolerant. Would you agree? And we are known as what? Intolerant. What's the definition of tolerance? Feel free to pull out your phones and hit the Google. What's the definition of tolerance? No. Tolerance is the ability to accept. Okay, what's your name, buddy?
Matt.
Yeah, Matt. You're a sports fan?
Yes.
Which sport?
Basketball.
What about NFL football?
Go Packers.
Okay, we can be friends. Because if you'd have said go Patriots, we'd have been done.
I agree. Okay, so,
oh! This gets better. Matt and I are so tolerant of each other. We like the Packers and we hate the Patriots. That's our definition of tolerance. Has anybody looked up tolerance yet? Really? You all have cell phones. Okay, fine. The definition of tolerance is this: to put up with people whose opinions are different than yours. So let me say this. I believe that followers of Jesus Christ should literally be the most tolerant people on earth. Because people who claim tolerance are not. See, Matt and I, we like the Packers, we hate the Patriots. We think we tolerate each other. We're not. We're speaking the same language. Tolerance requires you to disagree with me. And for me to love you and hear you nonetheless. The church needs to be a place of tolerance. And we're not sometimes. We are the place where we bring our big hardcover King James Version Bible and whack people in the head with it. That's what we're known for. We're known as people who stand against everything, as opposed to people who love other people. Jesus says, you know, people will know you're my disciples when what? You have love for each other. We can't love each other. Do you realize that? We have a hard time loving each other. I think I told this story last time I was here, but it's a fun story, so I'm going to tell it again. Teresa and I were traveling one time, and I'm in a hotel, and I look in this phone book, because I would look up churches when we travel, and there was First Baptist Church of Lucan and Greater First Baptist Church of Lucan. I love that, because you know what that is, right? That's a church split. And the Greater First Baptist Church was probably the second one. They left and we went, we're the Greater First Baptist Church. We can't get along. We can't put up with each other in the differences we have. How are we going to be influential in people that we fundamentally disagree with? I have a friend. He and I get together on a regular basis, and we are diametrically opposed in all of life's philosophies, but we talk all the time. And we talk about our differences, and we do so respectfully, and he explains his worldview, and I explain my worldview. And we don't get upset, and we go, don't get defensive, because we're friends, and we care, and we love each other. And my goal is to win him to Christ. His goal, I think, is for me to accept him. We have other friends who are Buddhists, by the way, and we spent an entire weekend with them, and it was the funniest thing because they spent the weekend trying to convert us to Buddhism. And so we had hours and hours and hours and hours and hours of talk, and finally at the end of it, here's what they said: we want you guys to be okay with us. See, we think that we have to convert everyone that we come across. And I think we need to be an influence with people. Jesus said we're salt and we're light and we're leaven. He didn't say we're hammers, baseball bats, in frying pans. Do you understand the difference? I made up those last three, by the way. See, salt spices things up. Light illuminates things, and leaven influences. That's what we're called to be. Jesus would say this in Luke 6:4, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eyes and pay no attention to the plank in your own?" You see, we look hypocritical when we point out someone else's fault when we are so faulty, polluted, and broken ourselves. There is a time when salt will sting, and there is a time when light will be a glare. But the reality is we need to be people who influence other people. Mark chapter 5, starting in verse 21, Jesus says this, "When Jesus again crossed over by the boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue rulers named Jairus came there. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him, 'My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live.' So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed around him." Now, would you agree that a little girl dying is an emergency? Would you agree that that is an emergency so that everything else that happens pales in comparison? Jesus takes off. There's a mob of people that take off with him. Verse 25, "And a woman was there who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years. She had suffered a great deal under the care of many doctors and had spent all she had, yet instead of getting better, she grew worse. When she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak because she thought, 'If I touch his clothes, I will be healed.' Immediately her bleeding stopped and she felt in her body that she was freed from her suffering. At once Jesus had realized that the power had gone out from him. He turned around in the crowd and asked, 'Who touched my clothes?' Yet seeing the crowd, people crowding against him, the disciples answered, 'You can ask who touched me?' In this crowd that is pressing around, you've got this woman who's been sick for 12 years. She's literally spent her life savings, and she thinks, if I can just get near Jesus, if I can just touch the hem of his garment, that will heal me. And so Jesus gets this response that Jairus' little daughter is dying, and they all take off in a rush, in a hurry, and she comes and she touches him. And I got to be honest, when I read this, it has a comedic feel to me a little bit. Because can you imagine this 100-plus people? They're all rushing to take care of Jairus' little daughter. Jesus is in the front. Everybody's behind him. She touches him, and Jesus stops. And I almost picture a Three Stooges motif where everybody runs into each other. And then Jesus says, "Who touched me?" And the disciples were like, "Seriously? Everybody's touching you, man." Jesus says, "No, somebody touched me." And he says, it says the woman, verse 33, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell at his feet, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth. He said to her, "Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering." In the midst of an important event, Jesus stops and he focuses on one person. But what happens next is even more significant. Verse 35, "But while he was still speaking, some men from the house of Jairus, the synagogue ruler, came and said, 'Your daughter is dead. Why bother the teacher anymore?'" Now, we could argue possibly that she would have died anyways. And we're not going to finish the story, but as a spoiler alert, it ends well. But here's what I think is significant in this story. Everyone in our path matters. Everyone in our path has value, even when we're in a hurry. Think about it. We're in a hurry and we miss stuff. Jesus did not. Let me give you some ideas on how to reach people. Be a person of grace. I'm not going to read all of these verses, but I do want to read some of them. John 1, 14 through 18. "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. John testifies concerning him. He cries out saying, 'This was he of whom I wrote, whom I said, he who comes after me has surpassed me because he was before me. From the fullness of his grace, we have received one blessing after another. For the law, the thing that judges us, was given through Moses. But grace and truth, the thing that frees us, came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, but God, the one and only, who is at the Father's side, made him known." Let's jump down, PowerPoint guys, let's jump down to Colossians chapter 4. 4 chapter verses 5 and 6. Be wise in the way you act toward outsiders. Make the most of every opportunity. Let your conversation always be full of grace. Not judgment, not harshness. Let your conversation always be full of grace, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how to answer everyone. Hebrews 12:15. See to it that no one misses the grace of God, and that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many. If you want to be an influence in a world where our Christian influence is dying, then be a person of grace. Be a person who is gracious to people. Be a person who cares. Number two, be authentic. You know what the opposite of authenticity is? Dishonesty. Church is where we lie the most, I think, honestly. Be an authentic person. Put it out there, man. People like that. Just put it out there. I say stuff all the time. Now, I am not known for my filter, so I may not be the best illustration and example of this, but often if it comes to my head, I say it. There it is. Win, lose, or draw, man, I'm putting it out there. And I think I do it, and this is a little psychoanalysis, because ultimately at the end of the day, I want to see how accepting people are. I want to see if people are accepting, because everybody wants to be accepted. But our faith needs to be authentic. I was at a Christian bookstore one time, and they had this product called Testaments. Let me help you with that. Not Testament, like the Old Testament or the New Testament. This was Testa, M-I-N-T-S. Testaments, because nothing says Jesus loves you like fresh, minty breath. Right? It's gimmicky. Don't make your faith gimmicky. Hey, would you like a testament? Jesus loves you because you have bad breath. It's craziness. Jesus said in Matthew 23, 25 through 28 to the Pharisees, "Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and dish, and then the outside will also be clean. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You're like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of dead men's bones and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside, you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside, you're full of hypocrisy and wickedness." Just because we look good, just because we sound good, doesn't mean we are good. People want authenticity. People don't want perfection. People want authenticity. They want to see that you have a message that can heal broken hearts and broken lives, because that's where you came from. Number three, have compassion. How many of you are compassionate? How many of you would have to look that word up? Mark chapter 6, 33 through 34. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns to get ahead of them. When Jesus landed and saw a large crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began to teach them many things. Colossians 3, 12 through 13. Therefore, as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourself. The literal word means put on these things. These are your character: compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience. Bear with each other, put up with each other, and forgive one another. If any of you has a grievance against some, forgive as the Lord forgave you. That is what those who call themselves the church must look like. We need to treat people as though they have value. Let me ask you this. Do you see everybody that you come across with as someone having value? Even if they disagree with you. Teresa and I were in a conversation a number of years ago, and we were talking about hosting something at our church. And the person we were talking to said, you know what? I don't know if people here in the organization that we were working with would be comfortable coming to church. And I'm like, okay, that's fine. We could do it somewhere else. Somebody in a different room was listening to the story, and they came out, and they said, "That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. I'm an atheist, and I would go to church." And I said, okay, my go-to question, are you an atheist out of conviction or choice? She goes, I'm an atheist out of choice. She goes, you want to believe it? It's fine. I don't. So this opens up a whole conversation, and she pauses about 5 minutes into this, and she said, you know, I got to be honest, I've never had this conversation with a religious person before. And I said, why? She goes, because y'all get so defensive. And And I said, okay. I said, I understand that. And then she said, we begin to talk for a little bit more, and she ends the conversation with this question. So if I came to your church, would I get struck by lightning? And I go, I said, you know, I literally have never seen it, but to be on the safe side, I'd wear your asbestos underwear. Just right, just cover the bases, darling. They don't make asbestos underwear, by the way. I Googled that. I'm not naive enough to say that caring is easy, because it's difficult and it's time consuming. When we care about people, when we care for people, it's not trite words, it's investment of time. Listen to this. Rodney Stark wrote a book entitled The Rise of Christianity. The subtitle is this: How the Obscure Marginal Jesus Movement Became the Dominant Religious Force in the Western World in a Few Centuries. You got that? Now, he describes himself in the foreword as a person who is incapable of personal faith. So this isn't a Christian historian writing about Christian history. This is a non-Christian historian writing about Christian history. And he says this. He talked about the influence that Christianity had over paganism, and the thing that he found is, as he studied the growth and the rise of Christianity, it grew exponentially in times of the plague. Now, when we think of the plague, we often think of the Black Death that ravaged Europe. There were many, many plagues before that, and people were terrified of the plague breaking out. So what would happen is a localized plague would break out, and guess what would happen? People would flee the cities, because the closer you are, the chance you're getting it, higher your chance of getting it. So this is what they would do. Husbands would leave wives. Wives would leave husbands. Parents would leave children. Children, family members left each other to die. When you started showing symptoms of the plague, we're out of here. See ya. Hope it works out. Be back in a month. Guess who stayed? The early church stayed. They decided that when Jesus said, have compassion and take care of people, he wasn't blowing smoke. He literally meant it. And so the church stayed and ministered to the sick and the dying, and they became the sick and the dying. But because plague doesn't have a 100% mortality rate, when people healed, guess what they recognized? My husband, my wife, my kids, my parents, everybody left me except Bob, the Christian guy. He stayed and he took care of me. And this guy determines that when people put feet to their faith, we're talking serious feet to your faith, kids. I'm not talking about, oh, you've got a cold or a flu? Here's some chicken noodle soup with my mask on. They stayed and they died because they believed strongly enough in what Jesus did. The church grows when we put aside our selfishness, when we risk it all to take care of people. See, we have this idea that we're going to take our Bible and we're going to expound theology. People don't care about your theology. They don't. Anybody that comes here and reads your doctrinal statement, let me just roll my eyes. Right? I want somebody to come to church that doesn't even know what a doctrinal statement is. I want people to come because they've understood what love and grace and compassion looks like. Sandra Aldridge writes this: truly, we live in a world that desperately needs a smile. A friendly touch, a kind word. Our encouragement can make a difference in the daily challenges we all face. But encouragement can also make a difference for eternity. And that's the real power to change a life. Okay, we're going to do an age test here. How many of you remember the rock, Christian rock group Petra? Okay, we're going to do a little trip down memory lane. I'm not going to sing it to you. But they write this: another sleepy Sunday, safe within the walls, outside a dying world in desperation calls. But no one hears the cries or knows what they're about. The doors are locked within, or is it from without? Looking through rose-colored stained glass windows, never allowing the world to come in, seeing no evil and feeling no pain, making the light as it comes from within so dim. I think that song is written in like the 80s, for those of you who are wondering. Outreach is not just telling people about the gospel. Outreach is living our faith. I read a story. Guys going through Taco Bell. How many of you like Taco Bell? Really? Taco Bell is like awesome. There are two foods. If I was being executed, there were two foods I would eat for my last meal. Taco Bell and my wife's beef stroganoff. I'd have both of those as my last meals. Guy's driving through Taco Bell, and he does this. He says, hey, I'm going to pay for the meal of the car behind me. So he does, and he gives the guy a card that says, I'm from First Community Church. Boom, there you go. He said, all I ask is that you give this person this card. Car behind him is a single mom with two kids, worked all day. She's tired. She doesn't want to go home and feed her bratty little kids. So she digs through the car. She finds all the change she has. She goes up to pay for the meal, and lo and behold, it's paid for. Guy says, guy in front of you paid for her? He just wanted me to give you this card. She goes to church the next Sunday. Months later, she accepts Christ. Heard another story. Brian McLaren's walking through a parking lot. He notices this girl trying to put this tuba in her car. Have you ever seen a tuba? Tubas are massive. So he helps her. He helps her get a tuba in the car, and as they're trying to force the tuba into the smart car, I don't know if it was a smart car, but that was funny. They begin to talk. She finds out he's a Christian. She's like, well, I'm not really religious, but I have questions. They swap email addresses. This starts a 2.5-year email communication, and at the end of 2.5 years, she comes to Christ. Let me ask you, can you do that? Can you buy somebody a meal? Can you help somebody put... See, we look at evangelism, and churches do this. I'm over time. Will you all forgive me? I get paid by the hour, so it doesn't matter. I don't know if your church does it, but I've done it, and I've seen it done, where we bring extraordinary people in to give their extraordinary testimonies. Don't you like that? And we're going to have so-and-so, and they have that, and we sit there, and we're like, oh, wow, that's extraordinary. I wish I was like that. You're not. Just let me put it out there. I mean, I've been looking at you for like the last 40 minutes. Not many of you look that extraordinary. I'm not trying to be rude. I'll give you five, maybe five, and I think I'm being generous. Right? We bring in, we want extraordinary stories. Do you know why? Because we don't think we're extraordinary. So we're like, I don't have to do that. That's an extraordinary person. I'm just an ordinary person. Remember the kid with 5 loaves and 2 fishes in like a bazillion people? And Jesus, the disciples like, how are we going to feed? The kid's like, I got lunch, man. Jesus said, perfect. 5 loaves, 2 fishes. We could feed 10,000 people easy. You can do ordinary things because you are ordinary. How many, be honest, how many of you go, Greg, you're wrong. I am extraordinary. I got one. No, actually I don't. Ed, put your hand down. See, we think that we have to be extraordinary, and that excludes 99% of us. If Jesus said this, you will receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you will be my witnesses to the ends of the earth. He met everybody. He met the extraordinary and the 99% of us who are ordinary. We can do this. We can take our 2 loaves, 5 loaves and 2 fishes, whatever. You know what I'm talking about. Do actions count as evangelism? I would propose to you that they do. And that how we treat people matters. I'm going to end with a story. When I was in grade 10, I had a biology class. And I liked science, so I liked my biology class. But the problem was my biology class happened right after lunch. And when I was in grade 10, I was a bit of a bad kid. And my lunch break entitled this. We would all go out and meet in somebody's car, and we would smoke pot. That's what we did. Now, my stepmom owned a bar, and I made a key to the liquor cabinet. I was a very popular kid in grade 10. And so sometimes we would bring booze to our lunch breaks as well. So we would smoke dope, and we would drink Jack Daniels, and then I would go to class. And I just want to say dope and Jack Daniels makes science class much more interesting. Now, at the beginning of the year, our teacher paired everybody else up. You had to have a lab partner. And my lab partner was the son of the local Baptist pastor. Yeah, that's probably what he thought too. So every day, Monday through Friday, I would come into science biology class totally wasted. And he had to put up with me. And I was slightly difficult. And this kid would share his faith with me, and he would invite me to youth group. And I would mock him, and I would belittle him, and I would be belligerent to him. And this went on from September to March. Every day, 5 days. And this kid had to go to the teacher and go, please, 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 please. I will take any, I'll take the dumb kid. Just don't give me Greg. But every day, this is what I did. There were no exceptions. We smoked pot. We didn't drink all the time, but we did smoke pot every day. And then I got kicked out of the house. I bet you're surprised. And I left town, and I never came back. And about 6 months after this, guess what happened? I ran into Jesus. Because my sister was a Christian, and she said, if you're going to live with me, you got to go to church, which was literally a fate worse than death. But I did. And I sat with the pastor in the car when he explained the gospel to me, and I accepted Christ. This kid, whose name I cannot remember because I was stoned, and it's not like I can track him down on Facebook because I literally have no clue what his name is. It's not like I remember his first name. I don't know who this kid is. We're going to get to heaven, and I'm going to be there. And I can almost picture him going up to Jesus going, Lord, I think there's been a mistake. I think there has been a terrible, terrible mistake. There is no way, and maybe I'm putting words into his mouth, but there is no way that that kid thought that what he said to me would ever have any influence at all. And yet it did. Listen, you have no idea the influence, good and bad, that you have. Are you the type of person that repels people from Jesus? Or are you the type of person who draws people to Jesus? We can do this, you guys. We can be those people. We can be people that help somebody load their tuba into their smart car, or buys a meal for somebody at Taco Bell, or helps someone out, or is just a genuine blessing. See, you all think sometimes you got to go to the street corner with your Bible, stand on your box of Tide, and preach. Nobody's going to. Okay, there's a guy in Kitchener that does that. But for the most part, nobody's going to do that. If I said, that's what I want you to do, you'd be like, yeah, no, that's not happening. But if we take our lives and be people of grace and people of compassion and people of caring, you never know. That guy that you think may not ever come to Christ might stand up before you one day and preach. Let's pray. Father, thank you for who you are. God, the fact that you are way more patient with us than we are with ourselves. And Father, I pray today that you bring people into our lives this week who need to hear about you. Father, that you would teach us what it means to be people who are gracious, people who are tolerant, people who are compassionate, people who care. And Father, that we would put those things into practice and be part of someone's spiritual journey to you. And we just thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.